Okay, here we go. Stand by. 3, 2, 1.
The Thinking Atheist. It's not a person. It's a symbol. An idea.
The population of atheists in this country is going through the roof.
Rejecting faith. Pursuing knowledge. Challenging the sacred.
If I tell the truth, it's because I tell the truth. Not because I put my hand on a book and made a wish.
And working together for a more rational world.
Take the risk of thinking for yourself. Much more happiness, truth, beauty, and wisdom will come to you that way.
Assume nothing. Question everything. And start thinking. This is the Thinking Atheist Podcast, hosted by Seth Andrews.
I'm talking on this broadcast about the insurrection of January 6th, but more importantly, and I think more broadly, this sort of Christian nationalist idea that we are a theocracy, we are one nation under their specific God. Andrew Seidel, he is a friend, he's a constitutional attorney. I kind of caught him after hours. You know, he normally is working for the Freedom From Religion Foundation, but he's also an activist in his own right. He's written the book, The Founding Myth, Why Christian Nationalism is Un-American. There is video of our conversation. The YouTube link is in the description box of the show. Now, since we're going to be talking some about the Founding Fathers and a lot of the things that Americans get wrong about the Founding Fathers, you want to take a deeper dive into who they were, what they did, what they believed and didn't believe. The lecture series, America, the State of Our Democracy, was filmed live in New York City. And the series has three fascinating speeches given from the stage by experts in our history. And they explore just how unique the American experiment was and is, the intent of the founders against what we're seeing today, the fragility and the resilience of American democracy. This is a must-watch at The Great Courses Plus. It's also a great tie-in to today's conversation. You can watch it totally free right now with your 14-day trial, and you can browse thousands of other lectures on a huge variety of subjects, streaming anytime, anywhere, including on The Great Courses Plus app. I have found it a wonderful way to learn. I want you to try The Great Courses Plus, too. Get started with a free trial of unlimited access. Just visit my special URL, thegreatcoursesplus.com/Seth. That's 14 days to learn anything you want for free. So sign up now. Remember, thegreatcoursesplus.com/Seth. This is a thick little conversation. People are like, well, why are you talking politics? And I'm like, tell me how we can extract Christianity from American politics and we'll stop talking politics. I've got Andrew Seidel from the Freedom From Religion Foundation joining me here. Hey, brother, how you doing, man?
I am well, Seth. How are you?
You are watching the headlines and you are probably face-palming yourself through the walls of the FFRF. I don't even know where to start, but you've been tweeting a lot and writing a lot about Christian nationalism. I guess we start with the definition. How would you define it for the audience?
So Christian nationalism is a political theology, an identity. It is the idea that the United States was founded as a Christian nation, that we were based on Judeo-Christian principles, and most importantly, that we've strayed from that foundation, that we've gotten away from our godly roots. And Christian nationalism is an effort to return us to this non-existent mythological past. And essentially, they want to redefine the American identity and then rewrite our law accordingly, with the end goal being that Christians, and that's not quite right, really the right kind of Christian, are a special favored class and everybody else, second class citizens.
We are in a desperate fight for our values, and on Christian nationalism is on the wrong side of that. Patriotism has no religion. You know, we the people is the word, those are the words that begin our Constitution, and they're poetic, but they're also so much more. Those words were revolutionary. Our Constitution was the first not to mention a God, not to invoke Jesus or a deity, the first to ban religious tests for public office. America invented the separation of state and church. It's an American original. The idea was born in the Enlightenment, but it was first implemented in the American experiment. And I, for one, am proud of that fact. And I wish every citizen were proud of this American invention. And I certainly wish there were far fewer trying to undermine it with myths about a Christian founding.
I have been saying now for almost 2 years that it is an existential threat to the Republic.
Which sounds like hyperbole. I mean, you say that. You say that, and they're like, oh, come on.
Yeah.
I mean, we've been talking about, you know, in God we trust, and God bless America, God bless our troops. You know, we've been invoking God forever, I mean, supposedly. And we haven't seen anything like you're talking about, except we now kind of are, right? You want to speak to that?
Yeah. I mean, the subtitle of my book is Why Christian Nationalism is Un-American. And my mom texted me this. She said, so let me get this straight. The subtitle of your book is Why Christian Nationalism is Un-American. And then Christian nationalists attacked the U.S. Capitol on January 6th and proved you correct. Like, yeah, basically, Mom, thanks. Thanks for the support. Moms are great. It is fundamentally un-American, and it is a fundamental threat to our republic. And we're seeing it now, but to me, this was so predictable because we've seen it before. In the founding myth, I talk about how there have been waves of Christian nationalism throughout American history, including preceding the worst violence internally that this country has seen, the Civil War. I have a chapter where I talk about how, to a larger extent than we've ever been willing to discuss, the Civil War was a religious war. And it was partly because religion injected itself so much into our politics that it made a peaceable, democratic solution impossible. And it actually helped foster violence because you have two groups on either side of the same issue saying, no, no, God tells me I can do this. No, no, God tells me I can do this. And it makes any type of negotiation or compromise or anything impossible. And we've seen waves of Christian nationalism throughout American history. They don't often crest into violence, but it's happened in the past, and this was completely predictable.
Some recent statistics and studies. Now, we have to be careful because, you know, statistics are bandied about left and right. But some alarming data coming in.
Yeah. I mean, 98% of statistics are made up on the spot, too. I don't know if you're aware of that. Yeah.
What is that? Yeah. Inspirational quote here, and then you just put Abraham Lincoln's name under it, and, you know, he automatically said it. But, I mean, statistically, according to some recent surveys, 1 in 4 evangelical American Protestants believe some flavor of QAnon, some sort of, you know, these are the end times and Satan's trying to infect us. And maybe the Democrats really are part of a cabal of pedophiles wanting to overthrow the government and the election's not legitimate and I don't know, whatever. And then roughly 25 to 30% say that they can envision an instance where violence might be necessary to protect the United States against this sort of perceived coup. Have you seen any of these sort of surveys, statistics, these trends, and can you speak to them, Andrew Seidel?
Yeah, I mean, they're certainly coming out. And to me, again, this is another very predictable aspect of Christian nationalism. The Christian nationalist's entire identity is based on disinformation about the American founding, that we were founded as a Christian nation, that we were based on Judeo-Christian principles, that our laws are based on the Ten Commandments, that the founding fathers were all evangelical Christians who prayed at the Constitutional Convention, that the Declaration of Independence, it was based on the Bible, right? Like, that is their identity. That we are one nation under God and in God we trust. And so, I wrote the founding myth not just to debunk those lies and that disinformation, but I actually said this in the introduction of the book, that this book is an assault on the Christian nationalist identity. Not only are they wrong, their beliefs and identity run counter to the ideals on which this nation was founded. And the point that I'm trying to get to is that an identity based on disinformation is susceptible to other strains of disinformation. You know, so I wrote in the book something along the lines of, I wrote that the religious mind is primed to accept lies. When presented with an extraordinary claim, it doesn't demand extraordinary evidence, but instead engages its faith to overcome skepticism. So this religion has taught evangelicals to accept rather than to question, and especially accept from authority and authoritarian figures. So Trump's constant waterfall of outright lies landed on these just pliable, amenable minds. And there's a lot of data to back this up too. His support was much greater among regular churchgoers than it was among, for instance, lukewarm believers. We know from the work that we do, right, that the greater the faith, the more subordinate healthy skepticism becomes. So I wrote in the book that the biblical fetish for totalitarians may have helped America elect its first. And again, that's 2 years before January 6th. So, this to me was all sadly predictable. And I feel like, the voice crying alone in the wilderness for a long time. And now finally, it seems like the country is waking up to the threat this poses. And I'm thrilled that that's happening. But the question is not, what is Christian nationalism and how do we study it? What do these people believe? It's how do we fight it and push it back to the fringe whence it came?
There's so much to unpack here. We speak to the fact that fundamentalists are primed for authoritarians, right? Yahweh, the ultimate authoritarian. Yeah. So they believe that a prophet has been put into place or some supremely appointed leader. They just follow in lockstep because that's sort of what fundamentalist religions often prime you to do. I'm also struck by sort of the militarized language of fundamental Christianity. When I was growing up, they used to teach us, songs like Onward Christian Soldiers Marching On to War. So I'm a kid in private school, but we're not just singing the song. We're standing, we're doing motions, right? We're marching, we're waving flags. We see references to going to battle. We are warriors or crusaders in God's army. We talk about the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but they are mighty through God to the pulling down of strongholds. So now we're crashing down strongholds. We look at a sort of a predisposition to jihad, if nothing, sort of a Christian jihad. You would agree?
I would. Let's also state that it's better to be a warrior for good than it is to be a warrior for God. But, I remember, Seth, in public school, I remember this in Maryland growing up in elementary school, singing Joshua Fought the Battle of Jericho. Yeah. And then reading that as an adult later on, reading the Bible, and that's a genocide. That is the story of genocide, of one people exterminating another. And I was a little kid singing about that in public school, and that song is stuck in my head to this day. That's how impressionable we are back then, right? And again, the ties are clear. There was a group at the Capitol on January 6th of insurrectionists called the Jericho March. They were blowing shofars, the ram's horns. They were marching around the Capitol, and they helped organize this protest that devolved and became an attack. And this is a group that has named themselves after an act of genocide. How can we not expect violence? How could we possibly think that it wasn't going to happen?
When you watch the video of the insurrection and you saw the signs, many of them invoking God, we see crosses, we see invocations of one specific faith, Christianity. Everybody thinking they're doing God's good work as they crash into our institutions of government and endanger and even, how many people died? Was it 5 people who lost their lives?
And 2 others tipped their lives afterwards as a direct result.
So, it's unbelievable. If I knew that things would get crazy, but I never thought we'd see this. And I've had it posed to me that what happens if you have an authoritarian who is pandering to evangelical Christianity in the way that Trump did, but Trump wasn't very competent. What happens when you get in someone who's really, really smart and knows how to game that? They know how to outsmart the system. I don't know, have you had an opinion on what happens if we see another sociopath pandering to the evangelical authoritarian right, whatever? Do you talk about these things?
Yes. I mean, I think one of the things that's really remarkable about January 6th and about the rise of Trumpism and Christian nationalism in general. You're right. Like, Trump was actually very adept at taking advantage of Christian nationalism. And we saw that in the imagery from the attack. I mean, countless crosses, some of them 8-10 feet tall, the Christian flag carried onto the floor of the U.S. Senate, the Jesus 2020 banners, the prayer on the floor of the U.S. Senate, the appeal to heaven flags, make America godly again, a new spin on MAGA was there. I mean, Jesus saves, in God we trust. Like, I mean, it's very, very clear. So Trump was adept at tapping in to that undercurrent of Christian nationalism. But you're right, he was inept when it came to being an authoritarian. He didn't know how the government worked. And we like to think that our institutions saved us on January 6th, and I don't think that's quite right. I think we got lucky on January 6th. Our institutions did prevent Trump from doing a lot of damage, but he also did extensive damage to our institutions. And if somebody were more adept and had a better understanding of our government and how it worked, it would be very easy for them to dismantle it. That's what we have seen with Trump. And that is, I think, the silver lining of the Trump era, right? He exposed many of the weaknesses in our system. And what we have to do is turn around and fix those institutions. They have to be structural fixes so that something like this can't happen again. I'm deeply concerned. And I think you're seeing I won't say the heirs apparent, but that's what they would like to consider themselves. I mean, Josh Hawley and Ted Cruz are angling for this. I mean, very, very clearly, you've got Josh Hawley out in front of the Senate, you know, throwing up his fist to this crowd of attackers. And he is just a virulent Christian nationalist.
I don't know if you've hashtagged it, but you keep talking about unfucking the courts. You say, unfuck the courts. Okay, so we have seen, though, the injection, Supreme Court's the easy example. You know, we live in a nation where roughly a quarter of our citizens identify as non-religious, not necessarily atheists, but they're not engaged in or interested in religion. You look at the Supreme Court, it looks like Catholic Mass with a few people who are Jews in marginally practicing capacities. I think there may be an Episcopalian in there somewhere. This is not a representative court. How do we unfuck the courts, in your words, Andrew Seidel?
my tweets. I mean, our courts are broken right now. And it's not, we should be clear that it's not just the Supreme Court. It's all the way down. The federal judiciary has already been packed.
Okay, well, let me jump in quickly, Andrew.
Sure.
Are you saying that over the past 4 years, they have been strategically packed, or has it been going on longer?
I'm saying over the past, you can go back beyond 4 years. Really, it's more like 6 years, because there was a deliberate attempt to slow down as much as possible the previous administration's ability to place judges in the federal judiciary so that there was a vacuum. I mean, there was a huge deficit in the number of judges on the judiciary already when Trump took office. And then they strategically flooded the judiciary with these extreme candidates who now have lifetime appointments, unqualified in many circumstances, Christian nationalists and many others. And again, not just the three that Trump was able to put on the Supreme Court, but all the way down to the federal district courts.
And how hosed are we? Many of these are lifetime appointments.
They're all lifetime appointments.
Oh my God.
It will be... This and the Christian nationalism, which if we can put it back on the fringes, we will be okay. But the judges are going to be a problem for our generation. I mean, you're talking 30, 40, 50 years.
Do you support the expansion of the Supreme Court to include more seats to compensate?
Absolutely. I think the entire federal judiciary could be doubled tomorrow. One, they need that. I mean, they're overwhelmed and overworked, so that'd be a good way to do that. But it would also, I'm all for that in terms of diluting this deliberate power grab. I mean, they are working to solidify minority rule. Not that there's already plenty of structures in our federal government that solidify minority rule, but that they're doing that with the judiciary now too. Yes, it is deeply, deeply problematic.
Do you support term limits for judges?
I mean, in theory, yes. For me, the problem with term limits is that the Constitution guarantees judges a lifetime appointment. So I think if you spend your political capital trying to craft term limits or some creative way around the lifetime appointment clause in the Constitution, that amounts to term limits. Like, they're technically still on the bench, but they rotate off for 10 years and on for 10. Like, you hear these various sorts of policies put forward. The problem is that the people who decide whether or not that's constitutional are the judges who you're trying to take their lifetime appointments away. I think it's very unlikely that a term limit provision survives a challenge in the federal judiciary. So if we put our eggs in that basket, we are, I think, losing. I think it's far better to take all the political capital and the recognition that we're seeing grow that we need to fix the courts. I think it's important to take that and use it for a long-term lasting fix, to go big or go home, not try one of these smaller fixes, that especially one that might get struck down and then we're right back where we started.
You wrote the book, The Founding Myth. Let's just cover that ground real fast, because I come from a culture where George Washington, Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, they all went to church and loved Jesus. They decided that, you know, the best country was a country that loved Jesus. And I didn't ever do my own homework on that. I didn't look at the God on the Money or the Pledge of Allegiance. I mean, just sort of give me a greatest hits of bad arguments to promote the founding of this country as a theocracy, would you?
Yeah, I mean, the big ones are ones that everybody's heard. And again, the goal, right, is to form the Christian nationalist identity into the American identity, so that to be an American is to be a Christian, and to be a Christian is to be an American, to show that they are the true heirs of the American experiment, and everyone else, you're outsiders, you're immigrants, you're not true Americans, you're the others, you're otherized. Okay, that's the goal, and that's the goal behind a lot of the lies and myths that make up their identity. And people have heard these, right? One nation under God. Again, we are a nation under God. Therefore, if you're not under God, you're not part of our nation. In God we trust. If you don't trust in God, you're not part of we. The Declaration of Independence references the Christian God four different times. No, it doesn't. They're trying to claim the Declaration of Independence for their own. That the founding fathers were all evangelical Christians, you know, what you grew up believing. Like, that doesn't actually matter. Like, right? It doesn't matter what religion our founding fathers were. It matters whether or not they took the principles of that religion and used them to craft a government of the people, for the people, and by the people. And they didn't. We know they didn't. We've got the records of the Constitutional Convention. They didn't talk about the Bible at all. They didn't take their personal religious principles, whatever they might have been, and inject them into the country. But again, the point is, look, we are the true heirs of the people who created this nation. If you don't believe like us, you're not. And this is one of the reasons that I really, in the book, I try to say, like, this is a fascinating conversation about the founding fathers, but by having it, you're already ceding the argument. You've already lost the argument. We shouldn't be having that argument. We should be pointing out that it doesn't matter what religion they were. Let's see. They prayed at the Constitutional Convention when they were crafting our Constitution. They didn't. They prayed at the Continental Congress before there was a First Amendment, before there was a Declaration of Independence, when they were still British colonials. Like, I mean, okay, so what? The British colonies prayed that. What does that mean? That our laws are based on the Ten Commandments. The Ten Commandments are fundamentally un-American, right? Like, it would be very difficult to write rules and laws and sentences even that are more in conflict with the, for instance, First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution than the Ten Commandments. I am the Lord your God. You shall have no other gods before me. That is fundamentally un-American. You can have as many gods as you want in this country or none at all. Right. And I am the Lord your God. You should like the power doesn't come from gods in this country. It comes from we, the people. And all of the Ten Commandments, all of them, even the ones that people might not think, well, you know, what about murder and theft? All of them, the way they're written in the Bible, are fundamentally at odds with American law and justice and founding principles.
Now, I love getting together with casual Christians, and they say the Ten Commandments are absolutely the most important commandments.
My favorite.
And I say, okay, can you name six of them? Like, they know all the words to Bohemian Rhapsody, and they should. But they can't tell me six of the 10 of the most important rules. Let me backtrack real fast, because you said something about the Declaration of Independence, which is something I heard from a pastor recently. We were having a discussion, and he said, well, you know, why would they include that invocation of the Creator? Our rights come from the Creator, or whatever, in the Declaration of Independence, this sacred document. Why would they bother to put it in there if they didn't intend for us to be a Christian nation? Your response to that would be what?
Well, it says their Creator, first of all. It's not the Creator, which suggests not a shared view, right? Like, it's not our Creator or the Creator, but their Creator. And there's a couple different things here. And this is a place where you kind of need to do a little bit of a deep dive. And so I have two chapters in the founding myth on this, because you're talking about natural law. That's what this comes down to. So the other one, another phrase in the Declaration that people love to quote is the laws of nature and of nature's God. And for some reason, Christians think that is an invocation of their God. I mean, like, I could see if you were, you know, a tree worshiper, why you would like nature's God is not the Christian God. And very clearly, we have Jefferson's other writings. We know that he was referring to natural law there. And this is where you start getting deep, because there's two basic threads of thought when it comes to natural law. There's supernatural law, God-given rights. And then there's natural law, which is human rights. You have rights simply because you are a human being. And we know that the founders were invoking the latter here, not the former. It does take a little bit of a deeper dive. And I do that in the founding myth. I've got two different chapters on this. I actually have all the four references that supposedly invoke the Christian God. I've got what was written in the original draft of the Declaration and where they were added during the editing process. Only one of them appeared in the original draft. It's a really, really fascinating conversation. But the other thing that I love about the Declaration that gets lost in this conversation is that it is not about the divine. It is not about the supernatural. It is not about the hereafter. It begins when, in the course of human events, it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another, and to assume among the powers of the earth. Like, it is about the here and the powers of the earth, one people, human events. And when we focus on the one or two errant mentions that could possibly be bent into a Christian God, we're losing sight of what they are telling telling us this document is about. And it is about the here and now. It's got nothing to do with God or the supernatural.
I like getting back to the sources of some of this stuff. Do you know who wrote the Pledge of Allegiance? And they'll be like, tilt. Did you know he was a socialist? And many of these people, you know, they go off on that tangent, right? Satan is a socialist. God, Jesus, is a capitalist. They sort of come from that point of view. Yeah. They're like, did you realize the pledge was written by a socialist? He thought Jesus would abolish all class systems and blah, blah, blah. And they just vapor lock. And in God we trust on the money. And you get into us versus, you know, communism around the world and sort of this national posturing. You've written about that as well. It's been your experience when you get into, do you know where this actually come from? We are a culture of celebrated ignorance on that score, right?
Indeed. And I have a chapter on each of those in the founding myth. But the thing that I try to point out is not only are none of those from the founding era. And yes, Francis Bellamy was a socialist preacher who later went to work on Madison Avenue as an advertising executive, like wrote a textbook on advertising.
Oh, wait a minute. I'm sorry. He was a socialist who then went into the free market.
Yeah, he became a madman. Yeah. So he's a really interesting guy. I have a chapter on each of those, and it's worth pointing out that they don't come from the founding era, but I try to take the next step too, because if you look at how they were added to our government, to our American vernacular, it was during times of national fear and crisis when Christian nationalists were deliberately taking advantage of the country that was under duress to impose their religion on all of us. So the first time In God We Trust shows up is 1863, when you have this preacher. This is when it really is decided that we're going to put it on our coins. A preacher wrote a letter to the director of the Mint, who was a guy who wanted to get Jesus Christ added to the preamble of the U.S. Constitution. The preacher said, look, we have this heathen, the goddess of liberty, on our money. We got to get the Christian God on there. I mean, this was a deliberate attempt to use the Civil War, when brothers are literally killing brothers, to impose their religion on everybody. And you have the same thing that happens with the 1950s, when we see all kinds of things crop up, from the National Day of Prayer to adding Under God to the Pledge, to adopting In God We Trust as the national motto and putting it on our paper currency, to building the prayer room in the U.S. Capitol. All this stuff kind of crops up then. And that's not only not from the founding era and this push against godless communism, as you said, but it's also a deliberate attempt to sell the American public on religion in an effort to repeal all these really important New Deal reforms that empowered we the people. It's, again, deliberately taking advantage of times of national fear and crisis to impose Christian nationalism on the country. And that's one of the reasons that when I saw this wave coming of Christian nationalism with Trump, that I was so desperate to get this book out and try to get people to wake up and give them the tools to fight back against this disinformation to destroy this identity.
We're going to talk more about the courts. We're going to talk about evangelical right-wing media, aka propaganda, and Andrew Seidel's perspective on what do we do about all this. We're going to continue next. Hang on. Continuing a conversation we're having about the state of the United States with constitutional attorney Andrew Seidel. I appreciate Biden in the fact that he, even though he's a devout Catholic, and he's always talking about God, and I'm like, just stop, right? The government is not a church. I have this conversation all the time. But at least he's acting in many ways in a humanistic way, even though he has all the freaking religious window dressing, which maddens me just a little bit. But we've got the National Day of Prayer, the National Prayer Breakfast, you know, and I'm just... And if you want to see an example of how this is not about the freedom of religion or religions, plural, then put an imam up there instead of a Christian preacher and have them wave the Quran or, you know, any other holy book. Did you see the Jeep commercial with Bruce Springsteen during the Super Bowl?
I did. Okay. I just went on a rant about that on FFRF's Ask an Atheist show yesterday.
Okay, well, for those who hadn't seen it, I get it. It's another call to unity and healing. There's emotive music, and it's very beautifully shot. And, you know, he's speaking in these sort of somber, thoughtful tones. And on its surface, it's hard to take issue with it after all the tumult that we've been through. The problem is if you stop for a second and actually think about the commercial, it revolves around a little chapel in the middle of the country. You walk in the chapel, which he does, and there's a map of the United States. And in the middle, there is a cross on the map. The message could not be clearer, in my opinion, that in order for us to have goodness and unity and peace and all these other things, We need to respond to the Christian God, and our future is a nation of Christianity. I mean, the message is Christian nationalism. This was your take, yeah?
Absolutely. I mean, and you know, I think drawing Biden into this is correct, not because he had part of the commercial. I mean, let me put it this way. There were two things that really bothered me about the commercial. The image was overtly Christian and, more importantly, overtly Christian nationalist. And so first issue I had is that religion will literally never unify us. It is the most divisive force in human history. And when you turn to religion to unify a nation, you are automatically excluding everybody who is not part of that religion. I mean, that's just, you're talking about a huge percentage of the country. I mean, we already talked about the numbers earlier. I think you could easily say you're talking 80 million Americans who are not religious. Plus, the cross is Christian, so you're alienating every non-Christian, okay? So congratulations, your message about unity has been fully undermined. You have defeated yourself. Well done, Jeep. I mean, so that to me is kind of one problem. And this is the same problem I had with the Biden inauguration, right? Like, you're talking about unity, but also preaching at the same time. Those two things are fundamentally at odds.
Oh, the inauguration was like Catholic Mass, right?
Yeah.
How many priests, an Episcopalian priest, how many prayers, the Bible. And fine. You want to own a 5-inch Bible that's been in your family for 130 years or whatever. But he should have taken the oath on a more unifying document like the Constitution, right?
That would absolutely be my preference. I mean, that really would. And, you know, it's... So, I mean, there's two things that we're talking about, right? There's when you're striving for unity, religion, turning to religion is a mistake, right? Religion only unites those who believe it. But the second thing, and this is where I think the Biden inauguration stopped short, but the Jeep commercial forged ahead, is the Jeep commercial went into Christian nationalism, not just kind of Christianity. And that's not counterproductive. That's not just counterproductive, right? It's dangerous too. I mean, this is what we've been talking about. I was blown away. I mean, this aired like a month after the insurrection at the Capitol. I don't know who thought that was a good idea, but you can see what is Christian nationalism is right there in that video, the flag and the cross, right? And the 48 states, they happen to leave out like Hawaii and Puerto Rico and, you know, all of the, other places where there's, you know, maybe not as many white people. It was just really interesting to me because the commercial, again, supposedly we're gonna do unity. Supposedly we're gonna bring the country together at this arbitrary center spot, but it promoted the lies and the myths of the most divisive political theology this country has ever known. It reinforced Christian nationalism to the 4 million people who watched that. And again, we've seen those waves of Christian nationalism throughout American history. I've never seen it adopted to sell cars, though, again, it was deliberately sold to the American people in the 1950s. So, I mean, to me, this ad wasn't just shameful and defeated the unifying message. I also think it was dangerous. If people don't believe me, just flip the channel, go watch the impeachment that's happening right now as we're talking about this.
So let's get into unity. It's another bumper sticker. It sounds good. Like, wouldn't it be nice to unify? We all come together. I'd like to buy the world a Coke. Kumbaya. We all join hands in hands across America. It's one of those things where if you don't stop to think about it, it really does sound good. But unity is so often a call to let people escape accountability. Like, I don't want unity with the people who smashed into our halls of government and betrayed the Constitution and harmed and killed people. I don't want unity with bigots and people who are doing real-time damage. Can you speak to unity from your perspective?
Yeah, I mean, unity doesn't come without accountability. I mean, trying to have the one without the other is impossible. We'll never really have unity until there is some level of accountability, both for that attack and for the damage that's been done to the country outside that attack. So, to me, if you care about unity, and if you want your party to get involved in that, you have to first of all get on the train of we are going to hold people who attacked our government, who tried to stop the the free and fair election in the United States from happening, we've got to hold them accountable. You have to be on that
train. If I can interject too, we're also seeing the same people who were like, fuck your feelings for half a decade, right? Now they're the ones who are calling for unity. It's a suspicious reversal now that they're having to sort of look at situations from the minority position, at least in terms of the presidency, right?
In terms of power, yeah. Well, I mean, and that's the second thing too. I think that there's a lot of confusion happening right now in the conversation. And I think the media is doing a fairly bad job on this point. People are confusing bipartisan with unity. And those are not the same thing, right? Like, depending on which poll you're looking at, like 70 to 80% of the country supports of the Biden administration's Recovery Act, the COVID Recovery Act. And that is a unifying measure by any stretch. If 80% of the people support it, that's unifying. The fact that the people who are elected on the other side don't, doesn't mean that it's not unifying. So we got to stop thinking about bipartisan and unity as the same thing. They're not. They're two very different things. And I think the media could do a little bit better job of that.
Because you and I don't have enough hate mail, let me toss this one out. We're talking about Christian nationalism. White Christian nationalism.
Oh, absolutely.
Is what you're seeing right now just inherently white supremacy?
Yes. And so I started up a little YouTube channel to talk more about some of this stuff. So the first video I did is what is Christian nationalism? And the second one is white supremacy and Christian nationalism. You know, what's the overlap between those two? And I joke about it in the video. And I was asked this question pretty much every book talk I gave in the before times. You know, if you look at the Venn diagram, it's a circle. And it is white Christian nationalism is what we are talking about when we say Christian nationalism. And there's data to back this up, too. So, for instance, I mean, the defining belief of a Christian nationalist is that they think the United States was founded as a Christian nation. But that means something very different to a white American and to a black American. And if you check out Andrew Whitehead and Sam Perry's research, they make a very convincing argument based on data on that point. So that's not just me spouting off. That's backed up by data. And I think the larger point can be seen. Like, if you go back and watch those videos that Representative Jamie Raskin is showing right now in the impeachment, and you look at these insurrectionists at the Capitol, to me, the thing that is always so striking is the sense of entitlement that they have. Like, they are assaulting the very beating heart of our government, and they are doing it with this sense of entitlement. This is our house. We belong here. We're doing it at the president's direction. And that comes, I think, from race and religion. They believe they were acting on Trump's orders. They believe they were acting on God's orders. Every interaction they've had with the police in their lives has probably been pretty positive. I mean, the entitlement comes from their race and from their religion. And if you watch the videos and think about that, it really came home to me. And if people are more interested in that, I do a little bit fuller of an explanation in that video. Over
now, what is that? Is it like a podcast? Is it video, audio? What is it?
It's a little video channel that I made up. So that's like original content. And then I have a playlist of like all my, not all my appearance, of many of my appearances, a playlist of some of my more fun appearances where I go on Right Wing Radio or Bill O'Reilly's show and stuff like that. So it's just, I do a few like live Q&As over there.
I got to go find you on O'Reilly. Back. That guy was just so cocky, just so smug. And I used to be an O'Reilly fan. I mean, I was a Fox News guy.
Yeah, right? I know. I read your book, yeah.
And I used to be like, wow, he's really smart and he's tough, you know. Now I look at Bill O'Reilly and I just shake my head and I think, wow, you know.
That was my first live TV interview. That was my first TV interview. It was Bill O'Reilly's show. So, talk about a baptism by fire. That was like my first time out.
Unresolved Problems segment tonight, another controversy over spirituality. Ever since George Washington, presidents have sworn on the Bible that they will protect the country during their inaugurations.
Preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States.
Preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States.
So help you God.
So help me God.
Now, the only exceptions to using the Bible were John Quincy Adams in 1825 and Teddy Roosevelt in 1901 after the assassination of President McKinley. T.R. used the Bible in his second inauguration. But now there's a move to remove the Bible from the inauguration ceremony permanently. On Monday, President Obama will place his hand on two Bibles, one from Abraham Lincoln, the other from Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Joining us now from Madison, Wisconsin, Andrew Seidel, who is with the Freedom From Religion Foundation. So, Mr. Seidel, Abraham Lincoln, Dr. King, two amazing American icons, you just want to take their Bibles and remove them from the ceremony?
Well, I much prefer Dr. King's writing on the letter from the Birmingham jail, where he actually talks about the white church standing on the sideline, mouthing trivialities and pious irrelevancies while he does the actual work of fighting for the civil rights movement. But the Bible itself,
you must know that Dr. King invoked God in almost every speech he ever made. And
yes, but the Article 2, Section 1 of the Constitution, which lays out the oath, does not say anything about the word, so help me God. It says, I will preserve to the best of my ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States, period. And it's kind of ironic
why George Washington
is going to amend that in the middle of it.
Do you know why George Washington wanted the words God, so help me God, in? Do you know why?
George Washington did not say, so help me God. The first recorded instance was 1881.
Oh, if you look at his inaugural address,
Washington Irving.
It's peppered with references to God. George Washington has
his inaugural address peppered.
Go ahead.
Washington Irving was the person who started the myth that George Washington said, so help me God, at the end of his oath. And actually, the French foreign minister was standing right next to Washington.
It wasn't, so help me God.
And it wasn't said. You know, he didn't say, so help me God. That's correct.
Do you know why Washington peppered his inaugural address with the word God? It's all over the place. Do you know why he did it?
I don't know that that's true. I haven't read his inaugural address lately.
And the reason he did, let me tell you why, and then you can respond, all right? He did it because the founding fathers, all right, in the Declaration of Independence, all right, based the Constitution
not our founding document,
inherent rights from God. All right. That's why he did it.
You can argue with,
when you get to heaven, you can argue with George Washington. All right, so
the
you
Constitution
want
is an entirely secular document. It doesn't mention God. It doesn't mention Jesus.
It's based on the Declaration
saying,
of Independence.
So help me God. It's most
Constitution,
not.
As you probably
in
know,
fact,
is even in
white. It's pretty striking that it doesn't mention
it. It isn't striking, Mr. Seidel.
Like
you don't know your history. You just don't know your history,
oh,
and I
differ.
Do. I know you would, but you're wrong. The Declaration of Independence set up the Constitution, okay? Inalienable rights given to us by God.
The Declaration of Independence severed our political connection with Great Britain.
It set up the Constitution.
The United States created our nation.
You know, it was so bizarre, Seth, because you know this, but people probably watching don't know this. Like, I went into a studio, and I had a Bill O'Reilly in an in-ear earpiece just directly into my brain, just like talking into my brain. And I'm just looking at a camera, and that's all it is. There's a monitor off on like the side over here, but if you look at the monitor, and not the
camera,
you look shady and you look like you're not being, so you have to stare into the monitor as Bill O'Reilly like yells directly into your brain and try to get a word in edgewise. I mean, his whole shtick is, as soon as you start to make a point, he's going to interrupt you and throw you off your game. Like that's their entire tactic. So you have to try to keep talking. And then there was like a weird delay with satellites or whatever. So it was a really interesting and awful experience, but I'd like to think I hold my own.
It's the same thing with Sean Hannity and Tucker Carlson, right? The guest is there to give them an opportunity to just tell you what they're thinking. Like, it's not at all about what the guest has to bring. They just need a villain or, you know, someone that they can stand on the soapbox.
Well, I like to think, I've been on Fox a few times now. The most recent times I was on was to talk about the White House Bible study. I was on Fox and Friends Weekend with Pete Hegseth and then some preacher guy. That's up somewhere, too. But they talked about my book. They talked about the founding myth, why Christian nationalism is un-American, without having me on. So it was Pete Hegseth, and then they had a panel of three religious leaders on to talk about it, including like Rabbi Zacharias and Robert Jeffress. And they didn't mention it by name, but they put up the title of an interview that I did with Salon.com about the book, and it was just it was an author interview. So there's no way you can like read the story and think, oh, this is actually like a news story. It was an interview with me about the book. They put that up as though it were a news headline, and then proceeded to dismantle the try to dismantle the arguments that I make in the book in order, but never mentioning the book. It was the weirdest experience, and it was one of my coworkers sent me a link, and they're like, hey, Andrew, I'm like pretty sure that they're talking about you and your book, but they never say it. Like, and I was watching, and I watched the, like, oh my God, this is the weirdest thing. It was so bizarre. So I like to think that they're scared of having me on now. That's how I'm going to read that situation.
That's how I would read it. Yeah. Oh, yeah. You're don't mess with Seidel. Kind of guy. I mean, if he's going to unfuck the courts, he'll definitely mess you up at Fox News. So, all right, my friend, what do we do now? I mean, how can you and I engage in a meaningful way to, you know, to help fix it? A lot of people, back when I first became an activist, they would talk about having like an atheist political party, which I think is just insane because atheism is just the lack of a belief in God. It doesn't necessarily mean anything else. I also think it's a top-down approach, right? I think the culture underneath, right? Doesn't the foundation of the country have to change before the government and the courts better reflect it? Am I right? Am I wrong? Is there another angle? I mean, how do we fix the country? Is what I'm saying.
Come well, on. Not to put all that on your shoulders. I'll give you that 10 seconds. I can tell you the answer for that.
Yeah.
I mean, to me, I do think, as I've been saying for almost 2 years, that Christian nationalism is the biggest threat that we're facing. I think a lot of the ills in the country can be traced back to that. The problem is that because this is an identity that is based on disinformation, that's going to be notoriously hard to unwind. But that's literally exactly why I wrote The Founding Myth. It's a different book because there have been previous books that have corrected the record, right? This is what history tells us, and this is what the Founding Fathers meant, but they left it at that. But right, correction and facts are not enough. And it's mind-blowing that we have to say that. But right, like Donald Trump wouldn't have been president if facts were enough, if pointing out errors was sufficient. So we have to do that, but then we have to take the next step. And that's what I really try to do in The Founding Myth. It is an assault on the Christian nationalist identity. Not only are they wrong, their beliefs and identity run counter to the ideals on which this nation was founded. They are fundamentally un-American. And we have to continue to point that out. And I think there's a lot of hope here. If you look at some of the research that Whitehead and Perry, who I mentioned earlier, have done, they think that about 20% of the country are like diehard Christian nationalists, but 32% are what they call accommodators. So that they're not maybe fervent Christian nationalists, but they accommodate that belief and help it grow and fester and even seize power. And those people can be convinced and shown the error of their ways and that it's wrong. And I think it's really up to us to be out there having these conversations and pointing it out. And so much of it traces to all these different myths that we've been talking about, one nation under God and God we trust, all that. So, I mean, that's why I wrote The Founding Myth.
Yeah, but how much of what we do now is just a sort of a political version of counter-apologetics? I mean, this is the OAN culture, right? This is the Newsmax culture. We've got platforms. The Republican Party defined by the MyPillow guy. Right. That's where we are. So it's a resisting of this weird floodgate or series of floodgates of Christian nationalist propaganda. Right.
Yeah. No, I mean, it is. The propaganda is all over the place on that side, too. But the narrative, it's also the narrative. Christian nationalism, white Christian nationalism, is the narrative by which the shrinking conservative white Christian minority is seeking to maintain power and political ascendancy over the majority that is interested in equality and racial justice and reproductive justice and environmental justice and economic justice. And as we near the tipping point in which that power and privilege are reduced to equality, they're going harder and harder and harder after those myths. Right. So it's up to us to kind of push back more. And I know it's hard. I know it's really hard to fight disinformation. And it's kind of a central question that people are having. You know, I've been talking with friends who have family members who've been sucked into this QAnon nonsense. And some of them are starting to wake up now, realizing that, oh, none of this stuff's actually happening.
I mean, that does bring the question, like, do they get so radical that even the radicals say, this is crazy? I mean, do they, because they're kind of like a cornered animal, right? They're looking at the demographic shift, and they're looking at their own obsolescence, so they wig out, and everything's, you know, the Democrat pedophiles who are funded by George Soros are drinking the blood of babies with Hillary Clinton in the basement of the pizza parlor before communism. I mean, you know what I'm saying?
Absolutely. I mean, they're not going to go gently into the obsolescence for which they are bound. They're going to rage against the dying of their privilege, right? And that's what we are seeing happening. It's up to us to force them into that obsolescence. You know, obviously I'm talking about with argument and dialogue. I mean, so it's, I know it's hard, but that's what we have to do. And I think too, to back up a little bit, you know, doing state church separation and, you know, professional atheism or whatever you would call it, trying to build a secular community and a secular political power base, I've always thought, doing this for a living, I've always thought that we were not going to win this fight in the courts. We are going to win it in the court of public opinion and with demographics, and then by eventually, yes, gaining some political power. Not by having a national atheist party, that's not going to work, but by bringing our goals into the mainstream. And one of the things that I love to point out and that I wish more of us would do a better job talking about is that state church separation is almost a silver bullet. And I get like for a lot of people, the idea of fighting for state church separation is that, like, this is kind of like a privileged fight. Like, what does it matter if the government has an official religion or if there's a national day of prayer when people are sick and dying and impoverished and homeless and out of work? Like, what does it matter if the courts are on the brink of repealing reproductive rights or our schools are failing and our healthcare is being ripped away? Like, what does it matter if the government wants to pray when our brothers and sisters are being killed in the streets and people are being thrown, children are being thrown in cages? And to me, I understand that, but I also think that it matters more, right? Like, the kids who were being thrown in cages were being thrown in cages because Jeff Sessions, the then attorney general, cited Romans 13, which he learned to do in the White House Bible study. Like, that, you can draw a direct line between every one of those kids sitting in cages and Christian nationalism. And whatever issues you care about, limiting power of religion in our government, ending the Christian nationalist influence, is going to help. I mean, it's not a panacea, but it's damn close. If you want better education, do you want full funding for public schools instead of vouchers for private religious schools? Do you want accurate science about evolution and sex taught in our classrooms? Do you want full civil and political rights for LGBTQ and women and minorities? Do you want reproductive justice and choice to be fully realized? How about a greener world and a healthier environment? Do you want us to get serious about global climate change and shun its deniers? Do you want access to better and universal healthcare? Do you want scientific research to be guided by scientists? Do you want to solve the problems in the Middle East? Like, do you want our response to pandemics to be guided by science and not wishful thinking? If you end Christian nationalism, if you end religious encroachments into our government, you will see progress on every one of those issues. So I get that secularism may seem like the fight for the few, the lucky, the privileged. I think it's a fight for all of us.
And the good news is that your version of the fight won't feature you brandishing an AR-15 next to desaturated photos of your political opinion or opponents, rather, that like Marjorie Taylor Greene. Is it hyperbole to say that she is the face of the 21st century Republican Party? Like, I don't see her as a one-off. Marjorie Taylor Greene. I think this is the state of the Republican Party in the 21st century, right? The Jewish space laser lady, right?
Yes. I absolutely think that's fair.
Hillary's eating babies lady. That's the 21st. I mean, that's not hyperbole, I don't think.
Yeah. So. And I should make it clear, I'm appearing on this show in my personal capacity, not in my professional capacity as a representative of an organization. But I think that is absolutely right. I mean, like, they voted on it. they voted on it, as far as I'm concerned. So,
but
yeah.
The idea that she was selected for a committee that had any influence on education in the first place.
It's,
in,
Yeah.
I mean, if you want a good example of my rant, which I apologize for, sometimes I get on the soapbox and you know how it is.
Go ahead.
It's a perfect example. She again, a virulent Christian nationalist. There was actually, FFRF did a report on the 147 members of Congress who voted against certification of the vote and tried to highlight their ties to Christian nationalism and their ties to their churches. And it was like 99% of them are Christians. And most of them were Christian nationalists. People can go check that out on the website. Again, appearing in my personal capacity at this point in time.
All right. Well, I mean, you actually sort of capped the show in such a great way. I probably shouldn't have digressed with the Marjorie Taylor Greene reference, but you know, I just shrug and say, I mean, I knew people were gullible. Hell, I was gullible. But I would like to think even when I was a true believer, I would have looked at that woman and said, she has checked out of the hotel reality, right? She is long gone.
Yeah. It goes to what you and I were talking about in, was it December or January, where we were asking the question with Rebecca Marker, like, do we live in a shared reality anymore?
No.
But right, that's part of the problem with your earlier question of like, how do we fight this? How do we do this? It's like, what we're really at, like, how do we get people back into this shared reality with us? And I think I've been thinking about it since long before then, but also since then, I think part of it is working to destroy those identities. And again, I'm not suggesting violence against a person at all, but those identities are based on lies and disinformation and myths, and going after those underlying lies and disinformation and myths is absolutely fair game, whether it's QAnon or Christian nationalism or religion in general.
It's like my favorite Ingersoll quotes, the more false we destroy, the more room there will be for the true. And I think
guy was so good.
That's just a great Andrew Seidel. You are always good. You are always a great guest. And I will link to your book and is it a YouTube page where you're posting your videos?
Yeah, my own little corner of YouTube.
Okay. All that in the description box. We will continue to watch the headlines and keep doing what we can, where we can, and all my best to you and your work. Okay.
Thank you very much, my friend. Appreciate it.
Follow The Thinking Atheist on Facebook and Twitter. For a complete archive of podcasts and videos, products like mugs and t-shirts featuring The Thinking Atheist logo, links to atheist pages and resources, and details on upcoming free thought events and conventions, log on to our website, thethinkingatheist.com.